Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Tonight's event brings together two superb American poets, Ted Kooser, who will read first, and Elaine Rawlings. I believe Kooser and Rawlings are a perfect pairing, not only because of the high quality of their work, but because their poems are so different, and contrast often makes for heightened interest, don't you think? Ted Kooser usually begins a poem with an observation outside himself. He lives in the country near Lincoln, Nebraska, and the world of his poems is a fully imagined world of apparently plain people and not outwardly dramatic events occurring in small towns. He also writes beautifully of the natural world, and whatever he touches, fireflies, a blind woman, a night class, a pair of surveyors working on a highway, quote, in their orange doublets like medieval pages, has wider reference than the subject itself, which he handles movingly with wit, grace, and frequently with rue. And he does so in often startling, sometimes quirky images that reverberate in one's mind long after you've finished reading the poem. Take one example. In a poem called Shoes from Weather Central, he writes, "In the shoe store storage closet, the smooth brown eggs of new shoes lie glowing in boxes." He goes on for a few fine lines and then says, "Let us not tell them just yet that they will all too soon be just like the others, their toes turned up from forever walking uphill in the rain." Sometimes a Kooser poem begins with a small event, dawn coming on, and later in October, dawn coming on later and later in a marvelous poem called October, and ends with a moving meditation on, well, what you will, loneliness, isolation, perhaps death. Ted Kooser is a vice president of not one but two insurance companies, Lincoln Benefit Life in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Surety Life Insurance Company of Salt Lake City. He's an adjunct professor of creative writing at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and is the author of 8 books of poems and a number of chapbooks. His books include Sure Signs, which was awarded the Society of Midland Authors Prize in 1980 and was featured on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. His other books include One World at a Time, 1985, and Weather Central, 1994, all published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. And so now I think it's time to hear from Ted Kooser.
I've always wanted to enter from the wings like that. It was really a thrill. Ordinarily, you know, they make you sit on the stage while they're talking about you, just squirming, you know, waiting. Come on. I like to begin my readings with this poem. So often over the years, people have asked me, to whom do I address these poems? And this is a poem called Selecting a Reader about that person. First, I would have her be beautiful, and walking carefully up on my poetry at the loneliest moment of an afternoon, her hair still damp at the neck from washing it. She should be wearing a raincoat, an old one, dirty from not having money enough for the cleaners. She will take out her glasses, and there in the bookstore, she will thumb over my poems, then put the book back up on its shelf. She will say to herself, "For that kind of money, I can get my raincoat cleaned," and she will. I write an annual Valentine poem. I've done this for 10 years, and although we're a week past Valentine's Day, I couldn't resist bringing this along. I'll read the poem, and then I have this whole stack of them that I'll give to you later. You can each have a Valentine. What I've done over the years is try to get some little symbol of Valentine's Day buried in the poem somewhere. In the alley behind the florist's shop, A huge white garbage truck was parked and idling. In a cloud of exhaust, two men in coveralls and stocking caps, their noses dripping, were picking through the florist's dumpster, and each had selected a fistful of roses. As I walked past, they gave me a furtive, conspiratorial nod, perhaps sensing that I, too, though in my business suit and tie, am a devotee of garbage, an aficionado of the wilted, the shop-worn, and the free, and that I had for days been searching beneath the heaps of worn-out, faded words to find this brief bouquet for you. I had a great aunt and uncle who lived way into their 90s. They were married for 72 years. And I was looking at some photographs of them, and this photograph really struck me, that was taken when they were in their 60s with many years of marriage ahead of them, and they had already begun to sit 2 feet apart on the bench, and which was typical. They lived in Clayton County, Iowa. There was not a whole lot of choice in mates in those. Would have been in the 1890s. And this poem addresses that photograph. This old couple, Nils and Lydia, were married for 70 years. Here they are 60 years old and already like brother and sister, small, lusterless eyes, large ears, the same serious line to the mouths. After those years spent together, sharing the weather of sex, the sour milk of lost children, barns burning, grasshoppers, fevers, and silence, they were beginning to share their hard looks. How far apart they sit, not touching at shoulder or knee, hands clasped in their laps as if under each pair was a key to a trunk hidden somewhere, full of those lessons one keeps to himself. They had probably risen at daybreak and dressed by the stove, Lydia wearing black wool with a collar of lace, Nils his worn suit. They had driven to town in the wagon and climbed to the studio only to make this stern statement, now veined like a leaf, that though they looked just alike, they were separate people with separate wishes already gone stale, a good 2 feet of space between them, 30 years to go. This is an experience I think we all share. It's called the urine specimen. In the clinic, a sun-bleached shell of stone on the shore of the city, you enter the last small chamber, a little closet chastened with pearl, cool, white, and glistening. And over the chilly well of the toilet, you trickle your precious sum in a cup. It's as simple as that. But the heat of this gold, your body's melted and poured out into a form, begins to enthrall you, warming your hand with your flesh's fevers in a terrible way. It's like holding an organ, spleen, or fatty pancreas, a lobe from your foamy brain still steaming with worry. You know that just outside a nurse is waiting to cool it into a gel and slice it onto a microscope slide, for the doctor, who in it will read your future wringing his hands. You lift the chalice and toast the long life of your friend there in the mirror, who wanly smiles but does not drink to you. I'll read a few poems from my most recent book. My father told me once years ago that the reason that all the pictures in the grade schools that we all grew up with are the same was because there were salesmen that traveled the country and sold portfolios of those pictures. The wolf looking down on the winter night at the blue cabin with the lights on, the Indian making the pot by the fire, the end of the trail with the Indian with the sagging spear, and so on. And I thought it would be fun to try to write some poems about each of those pictures that we became so accustomed to. And this one is about the Gilbert Stuart portrait of Washington, which, as you know, is that unfinished portrait of Washington with the bottom that is just raw canvas. You know it as well as the back of your hand, that face like a blushing bouquet of pink peonies set in the shadows of war. The father of our country, patient, sucking the past from his wooden teeth. His famous portrait, never completed, hung on the wall at the front of the classroom next to a black octagonal clock with the ghost of a teacher trapped inside, tapping out time with a piece of chalk. It was easy to see his attention was elsewhere. He'd left the dozen campfires burning out there at the front of his face, then retreated behind them. At 58, he was old and broken. This was no way to use up the days of a soldier. Celebrity irked him. He had little time for the likes of Gilbert Stuart, that son of a snuff-grinding Tory, that slackard who'd sat out the war with the English. Perched on a chair in a coal stone barn, according to Stuart, he smiled only once when a stallion ran past. He cared more for thoroughbred horses and farming than he did for the presidency. On the wall between us and the future, at the point where all of the lines converged, George Washington, like any other man, suppressed a deep sigh. So heavy was life, how futile it seemed to protest. We learned our lessons while the big clock clacked, its Roman numerals arranged in a wreath and sealed under glass. Those were lovely calico autumns, then winter passed with its long, clean pennants of light. Then spring with its chaffy rustle. We thought those aisles were parallel, that our days would never arrive at the vanishing point. Before us always, he who could never tell a lie kept his jaws closed on the truth. This is an attack on a kind of headwear. When my father died, in his closet were three of these little polyester hats that men in their 70s wear, that are so hard that you could stand on them to reach up to an upper shelf, you know, and they have little feathers on the side. And after he died, I began seeing men everywhere wearing these hats, and it occurred to me that perhaps the hats were the engines of their mobility and that the hats were pulling them on. So this is just a little short piece called The Little Hats. I saw the old men hanging down under their little hats as the hats pulled them stumbling along. Those polyester hats with little checkers, with little feathers, yellow and red. And their eyes were wide behind their shiny glasses and their cries pinched off in blue. And when they had passed and the bitter squeal of their cane tips breaking had faded, I saw there in the enormous window of the secondhand store cast off a row of little hats, streamlined and swift, their engines idling. A sound in the night. There's a clock at the end of the pasture talking and talking. It's my neighbor's new electric fencer, a red tin box with a steady pulse. On a night like this, chilly and still, you can hear it knock for 100 yards, counting the stars with its bony knuckle, a sound absurd against the darkness. But many of us have stopped in our places to listen. A mouse with a globe of dew in her paws, a coyote lifting his head from the grass, his wet tail tipped with starlight. Even my father, dead these 14 years, has heard the flat, remorseless counting and reaches out into the darkness and over the years for my mother's hand. This is the title poem of this book, Weather Central. It came out of watching the weatherman. You've seen them do this. The map is projected on the wall, and they, as they talk, they sort of massage the map. Weather Central. Each evening at 6:15, the weatherman turns a shoulder to us, extends his hand, and talking softly as a groom cautiously smooths and strokes the massive, dappled flank of the continent, touching the cloudy whorls that drift like galaxies across its hide, tracing the loops of harness with their barbs and bells and pennants. Then, with a horsefly's touch, he brushes a mountain range and sets a shudder running just under the skin. His bearing is cavalier from years of success, and he laughs at the science, yet makes no sudden moves that might startle that splendid order or loosen the physics. One would not want to wake the enormous Appaloosa mare of weather asleep in her stall on a peaceful moonlit night. I'm going to read three more poems and then stop. Hands in the Wind. These are newer pieces. Today I drove through a cloud of leaves, pale oak leaves the color of hands blown over the street, straight toward me out of the empty parking lot of the abandoned Kmart, their fingers swirling about me, feeling all over my car, over it, under it. I don't very often go past there. They must have been waiting a very long time to have been so excited to see me. They had probably blown there from trees in the cemetery just down the block and had gathered to wait, folded over each other, faded old hands with brown liver spots, young hands with a sheen to their skin. Then, when they'd seen my car coming, they'd rushed out into the traffic. It felt as if all of the people I've loved were suddenly swirling about me, wanting to touch me, wishing me well. I found myself laughing with joy. It all happened so quickly, and then they were gone. In the rearview mirror, there were only a few leaves still flying, a few fluttering down. They had settled in drifts by the curb, interlacing their fingers. They'd made a mistake. It hadn't been I whom they'd meant to make happy. They'd thought I was somebody else. This poem's entitled Lobocraspis grisifusa, and it's a scientific name of a kind of moth that I read about in a book by David Quammen, and it's a moth that lives on tears. No poet could resist such a thing. This is the tiny moth who lives on tears, who drinks like a deer at the gleaming pool at the edge of the sleeper's eye, the touch of its mouth as light as a cloud's reflection. In your dream, a moonlight figure appears at your bedside and touches your face. He asks if he might share the poor bread of your sorrow. You show him the table. The two of you talk long into the night, but by morning the words are forgotten. You awaken serene in a sunny room, rubbing the dust of his wings from your eyes. I'll close with this one. One of the joys of doing this sort of thing from time to time, traveling around and meeting all the wonderful people out there, and I was in Philadelphia reading at several colleges in Philadelphia, and I was invited for dinner at the home of a couple. The woman, Marcia Wertheim, is the step-granddaughter of John Cornos, who was one of the Images poets largely forgotten today. But she had in her possession, and after dinner she brought these out for me, these boxes and boxes of memorabilia from Cornos, including personal letters from Yeats and Eliot and Pound, and Yeats's little calling cards with little notes written on them, and these wonderful things that just completely blew me away. You know, and I had them all right there in front of me. And then she said, and I know, Ted, that you're interested in painting, that you've always liked painting, so perhaps this will interest you. And she brought out a wooden box and placed it on my lap, and it's that box that's described in this poem. It's called A Box of Pastels. I once held on my knees a simple wooden box in which a rainbow lay, dusty and broken. It was a set of pastels that had years before belonged to the Impressionist, Mary Cassatt, and all of the colors she'd used in her paintings lay open before me. Those hues she'd most used, the peaches and pinks, had been worn down to stubs, while the cool colors, violet, ultramarine, had been set, scarcely touched, to one side. She'd had little patience with darkness, and her generous heart had held only a measure of shadow. I touched the warm dust of those colors, her tools, and left there with light on the tips of my fingers, that hand and this heart, wrote these poems for you. Thank you.